So I don't know how many of you have already packed your bags. But if you have, unpack them. The retreat hasn't finished yet. Who knows what's going to happen next? Because there was a friend, he was a Kiwi guy. And he went to ordain, about the same time as I went to ordain, he went to a Korean monastery where they're really, really strict. No namby-pamby cream-puff meditators like Ajahn Brahm should be. These were the top guys a long time ago. Absolutely stupid. But what happened? He told me this story, that in that monastery every year, the monks, they did a really serious retreat for 60 days. It was a 60-day meditation retreat. And it was very, very fierce. So you would meditate for 50 minutes, get up and walk for 10 minutes, another 50 minutes, walk for 10 minutes, throughout the whole day, starting at 3 o'clock in the morning. And when it was time for breakfast, the monks who were serving, who went on a retreat, would actually bring them breakfast to where you were sitting. So you really couldn't sort of get up and have a stretch of your legs. So you ate your breakfast there, and then they took the plates away, and it was back to meditating again. 50 minutes, 10 minutes, 50 minutes, 10 minutes of walking. And then you'd have your lunch and the same thing happens. You wouldn't even leave the hall except to go for the toilet. And even then you had to ask permission. And sometimes the answer was no. And in the evening, now you could actually leave to go and see the teacher, the master, in the interview room. But the master never said, "Oh, very good." Whack, you stupid disciple. So even though it really hurt sitting, people still didn't like, they still did not go and see the master because they're afraid of him. And they'd meditate for about 10 o'clock in the evening. And at 10 o'clock, you didn't go back to your room. They gave you a wooden pillow and you slept where you were sitting right there. You couldn't even move. And you had to get up again at 3 o'clock. And so this was like enlightenment or bust. So, this young Kiwi monk, who, you know, like most Westerners, we haven't sat on the floor, we grew up sitting on chairs. So to sit so many hours, it's okay for like, the old days in Asia, everyone sat on the floor, you know, you sat on the floor to have your breakfast, you sit on the floor to talk to each other, you wouldn't have chairs. So, you know, your legs were used to that. But a Westerner, it was torture. Even after the first day, so many hours sitting cross-legged, you can imagine how much it hurt. And by 10 o'clock, you know, he was just so happy to lay down and go to sleep. But then he thought he had another 59 days to go. That was really tough. But, you know, like, one thing about sort of, especially Westerners, I must say this, they can really endure. They're very, very tough. They haven't got much wisdom, but they can be tough. So he sat there 2, 3, 4 days, and you know, he told me what happened, that, you know, he just was, you know, willing the clock to go fast so it could be 10 o'clock so he could lay down. And he would go to sleep, but almost like as soon as you go to sleep, you know, the bell goes in the morning, and you can't sleep in because you're right there in the hall with everybody else. There's no escape. So he had to get up and start meditating again. And it just passed just like a flash, the sleep. And he had to start meditating another day. And for those of you, no chairs, you know, just on the floor. I think they had one of these little cushions, which we use over here, these little sufferers. But other than that, sitting down hour after hour after hour. And that really hurt. If you've had sore knees, sore back, sore everything, that's what he had after 1 or 2 days. And it was just so tough. And he said many times that first week he just wanted to get up and go. But he was the only Westerner there. And, you know, he had like racial pride. I'm not going to give in while all these other monks are sitting there so damn straight. So he endured. And after 7 days he thought he was going crazy. Never experienced so much pain before in his whole body. And what really sort of ticked him off, really upset him, some of those monks, you know, the smart-ass monks, came to 10 o'clock, they didn't actually go and sleep. They just carried on meditating. You know what it's like, don't you? It's just really irritating. That person in your room is always up at 3 o'clock in the morning, always meditating, makes you feel so low. But anyway, so that he endured for another week. And when it got to 2 weeks, again, he really thought of giving up, but he thought he was going to be unfaithful to all the effort which he put in. He'd endured so much. And if he gave up now, it means all that endurance wouldn't be worth anything. So he kept on pushing and pushing. And the pain was just almost unbearable many times. He thought he was going to cry. But he kept through. And of course you get to the halfway mark. The 1 month, he'd done 30 days. And he thought, you know, after halfway, the rest is all downhill. Ha 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 ha. After halfway, that's when it really starts getting steep. And it was such an endurance. But, you know, he kept on going. And he endured so much incredible pain. You really respect the fellow for how much he can actually sit there and just endure. And it came to the last day. And at those retreats, after the retreat is over, I mean, they really celebrate. You know, they have, you know, hot baths, you know, beautiful feasts. They don't keep the precepts like we do. We can't eat in the afternoon. There was like a banquet arranged for them at the end of the retreat. You know, you'd really deserved it. They'd done something really wonderful, especially the hot baths. You can imagine just aches and pains all over yourself and just lying in a hot bath and all those aches and pains disappearing. He was dreaming of that hot bath as he woke up the last morning. But you may also notice when it's the last day is always the longest. The hours tend to go more slowly. Hour after hour, still not the last sit. But of course the time comes when it's your last session. One more to go, and then you can have your hot bath. But that 50 minutes was exceptionally long. You couldn't believe how long that 50 minutes was becoming. Because, you know, you're meditating, and if you're in pain, if you're having a hard time, you know, you're sure at least half an hour's gone past, and you open your eyes and sneak at the clock, 5 minutes. That's all. That's really unfair. And then, of course, you know, because he was in pain, he started sort of speculating, proliferating. He thought, you know, I'm sure that can't be 5 minutes. It must be half, at least 20 minutes. And he thought, what happens if the batteries were going low? And it really is half an hour, but only 10 minutes is registering. What happens if those batteries actually run out and the clock gets stuck? It's going to be torture. But the batteries hadn't run out. It was just the last 50 minutes when you really wanted to finish, last the longest of all. Pain, so slow. Seconds were ticking like they were hours. But finally, of course, finally you always have to have the final. The gong. The end of the retreat. And he said he had so much bliss just coming into his body. Even better than jhanas. No, not really. Because he'd actually achieved something. You know, it's an amazing feat which he'd done. To be able to sit there with so much pain, and even know that sometimes it's going to explode or just go crazy, he managed to endure, push through, and he made it in the end. And all the pain, he could feel the pain, but the bliss of achieving something, and also the fact it was over now, and bring on the hot baths, just gave him this incredible sense of pity, this joy and happiness. And they were about to bow when the teacher rang the bell again and said, before we go, I have an announcement to make. And he said that during your interviews, many of the monks here have been telling me how much progress they've been making and what a wonderful retreat this has been. And they've asked me, out of compassion, so can we please extend this retreat for another week? And I have considered their request, and I think it's a very noble request, so I've decided to agree to that request. The retreat goes on for another week. Cross your legs and carry on sitting. All the bliss disappeared. In a flash. And he had to cross his legs again. Another 7 days. But he said he didn't feel any pain. No pain at all. Instead, that was replaced by sheer anger. As he was trying to figure out what damn marks that were. Who said that? And also what he was going to do to him when he found out. Totally un-Buddhist. He was just so insane with rage that they could do such a thing. And he had to endure another 7 days of absolute pain. And he started figuring out all these ways of killing them slowly and torturing them. And then, another gong. About half an hour had passed by. Like in a second. Because that's what it's like when you're angry. Time flies so fast. And the teacher said, retreat over, the hot baths and the banquet is ready, go and enjoy yourself. And this young this young New Zealand monk, his name was Han Wall, a very great guy. He said, what's happening? Are we finishing? Are we starting? What's going on? And he was totally confused. And then one of the other senior monks came up to him, one who could actually speak English, and said, look, the teacher, he does the same thing every year. It was teaching him a lesson. Anticipation. Having hard and fast plans. That is what the cause of suffering is. So, I have an announcement to make. During your interviews, you say you've had a wonderful time, so this retreat is being extended. Unpack your bags, change your air flights. I'll not let you go. That didn't work, did it? Okay, the retreat is shortened. But whatever, the whole thing about anticipation, it kills you every time. And so he actually said to me, when he told me this story, I put it in Opening the Door of Your Heart, such a great story. He said that he learned more in that last half an hour than he'd learned in the whole retreat. He learned how the anticipation, that was what was causing the pain. There's one of used to be, anyway, it still is like a permanent anagarika. I better not say who he is because he's actually just visiting our monastery right now over the road. But I was going up to the workshop one day, this was quite a few years ago, and he was walking in the opposite direction with a pair of no pliers. That's right. And I looked, there was blood on the pliers. Are you okay? What's going on? And I looked closely, there was a tooth in the pliers. He said, what the hell have you done? I said, I just took one of my teeth out. I said, what? Well, it's much. And it's a long way to the dentist, you know, and you have to, you know, from here, it's about, you know, the nearest dentist in Byford, it's, you know, 20, 30 minutes away. And also you have to wait in the queue and make an appointment and all this sort of stuff, and it costs you money. So just do it yourself. And I was really impressed. Because, you know, there's a tooth there, you know, with blood on it, and the pliers. I said, how did you do that? And he told this amazing little way of dealing with pain. He said, well, look, when I decided to take my tooth out myself, without no anaesthetic, you know, just with a pair of pliers, then that didn't hurt at all. The decision never hurt. Even walking to the workshop, that wasn't painful. Picking up the pliers, that wasn't painful. Even putting the pliers on my tooth, that didn't hurt at all. When I wiggled it, yeah, that hurt, but only for maybe about 2 seconds, and it was out. And that's how I did it, he said. Just in the present moment, no expectations, no running off into the future, in the present moment, and nothing hurt except for two or three seconds. However, if you decided to do that, even before you picked up the pliers, it would hurt like hell. And that's what we mean about anticipation and making plans. That is a big problem. You know, every evening I usually like to go over to monastery for tea time with my monks. And we have some stupid conversations in that tea time. If you ever want to lose your faith in Buddhism, come to tea time with us. So So anyway, we're just talking about operations. It reminded me that I was in hospital. Last time I was in hospital was about 20 years ago. I didn't know what was wrong with me. But, you know, whatever it was, it fixed it up. So anyway, I was in this room with these four other guys. And if you've ever been in a hospital ward, not your own room, your own bed in your own room, with four other guys, and you're laying there all day, so you chat to each other, you talk to each other, and you get to know each other. And then we had this stupid conversation in this hospital ward. You know, what's the most painful operation or procedure? And then, you know, somebody said this and somebody said that. And one of the guys in the bed, you know, who'd been sort of in and out of hospital so many times, said the worst procedure is this barium enema. He said that really hurts. That's terrible. That's so uncomfortable. And the little guy in one of the beds went white. I'm having that this afternoon. It's really a stupid conversation to have. I felt so sorry, but we couldn't help each other. So much for my compassion, I burst out laughing with everybody else. But you can see how the anticipation causes the pain and causes the fear, which causes the pain, which means that the very thought of pulling out your own teeth, you know, with a pair of pliers, you know, causes you to shiver. Why? How many of you have ever taken out your own teeth with a pair of pliers? So you don't know what it's like, do you? So in other words, you know, you're just being afraid of something you don't know. And that's one of our problems. That we just expect, anticipate, plan. And we plan, it's going to hurt. Yeah, I know it's going to hurt. And of course then, it does hurt. Which is why for the last 7 days, how many days it was, I don't count. I've been telling you that meditation is easy. And you can get into jhanas, and you can get enlightened, and everything can happen. Have you noticed a few people have already left? So they're already enlightened, so you can go home now. It's only the slow ones are left. No, they had to go early for other appointments, but... You know, one of the most amazing things is saying, yes, it's possible. It can be done. If you say it's possible, it can be done. And it's amazing, then maybe it is done. You know, I think it was actually that I was told this in the Vietnamese tradition, that I think the monks in Vietnam, quite a few years ago, they had a big meeting and they decided not to teach the lay people jhana. They said, no, it's too difficult for them. It's too much for them. They won't even talk about it anymore. I heard that. I don't know if it's true or not, but maybe some of you scholars, if you know that tradition, will actually let me know if it was true or not. But I thought that's really discriminatory. And if you think they can't, of course they won't. So instead, you know, people like me coming along, ordaining bhikkhunis and just messing up and getting into trouble all the time. No, let's give it a try. So I decided, yeah, let's go and give it a try. Let's teach jhanas, let's teach everything. And for some of you, especially if you come here for the first time, first retreat, you think, well, this is just too much, it's too high. All these limiters and bliss better than sex. You know, it's enough for me just to sit down for 10 minutes and not think too much. You know, all this limiter business, that's really way above, you know, maybe I shouldn't be here, but no. Because when you actually teach high, people actually usually reach higher. I think it was actually Michelangelo. I think one of his famous quotes, he said, you should always aim above the target. You'll never reach your aim, but by aiming above the target, maybe you might hit the target. In other words, you actually aim higher than anything you will ever be able to achieve. And then you will always reach more high than you would otherwise. It's a very beautiful little saying. So in other words, don't so downplay yourself. And think, oh, I can't achieve these things. Oh, I can't do these things. Oh, you know, you have to be someone like Ajahn Brahm, who was born a monk. I was not born a monk. I was an ordinary guy, stupid, and the proof of that can be found in that 60th anniversary booklet with all those embarrassing photos of me as a baby and as a young boy, which was brought over by my brother without my consent. But nevertheless, it's there. So he's just an ordinary guy. But one of the things which I was encouraged when I was growing up was I always was around people who are really positive. Yeah, you can do it. Yeah, give it a try. See what happens. And that degree of like confidence to experiment and just to see what happens is, you know, one of the things which has driven my life. Yeah, give it a try. See what happens. Who knows? You know, you've got two legs like everybody else, so who knows what you can do. And with that possibility, you know, opened up, it's amazing what you can achieve. And just how far you can go in meditation and also in Dhamma. So never think, I can't. As far as the texts are concerned, real Buddhism is concerned, the only people, the only human beings who can't get enlightened, who can't get jhanas, are people who have killed an arahat, who have raped a bhikkhuni, who have caused a schism, or have, what's the other ones, you've killed your parents. No, deliberately that is, and not through wearing them down with all your incessant demands and being naughty. But really killed them, murdered them. And they say also like drawing the blood of a Buddha. So, is there anybody here who qualifies under six things? Has anyone killed their parents? No. Has anyone shed the... has anyone raped a bhikkhuni? Has anyone killed an arahat? No. Then you can all get jhanas. Whoopee. You can all become enlightened. Whoopee. So why haven't you? Now, a lot of the times it is because somewhere inside of us we think, oh, we can't. Some of you think, and I've seen this, it's not so much in the United States, in Asia, I'm only a woman. I can't do this. Stop that silly thought. What is a woman anyway? What is a man? Sometimes I look at myself, especially when I go travelling, because I go travelling a lot, and you go to airports in foreign countries, and they have the names of the toilets in their local language. I don't understand them. So I don't know which is the male and the female. So I look at the sign outside, you know, those little stick figures, the man and woman outside, and I look at them and I look at what I look like. And if I wasn't on the board, I'd go in the wrong cubicles. What is a man? What is a woman? Anyway, when you get into deep meditation, it's a great thing. You leave your body. In other words, you know, there's no seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. Your whole body disappears. You go to the realm of the mind. And you know, that's part of Buddhism. The mind has got no gender. It's not male or female. Your body is. So you're wrapped up in this female body. You're wrapped up in this male body. You're wrapped up in a gay lesbian body. But inside, your mind is exactly the same as everybody else's. That's a wonderful thing to know. That means that once you get in contact with your mind, you understand this inner emperor inside yourself, you really get to know it. That's where you realize that there is no sort of separation anymore. You can relate to people on the realm of the mind, not on the realm of the body. And then there's no separation. That's one of the reasons. Somebody asked me, why in some retreats we separate the boys on one side, the girls on the other side? Here we don't, because the minds cannot be segregated. You close your eyes, you get deep. There is no woman's mind. There is no man's mind. It's just a mind, that's all. All totally the same. It's beautiful to know that and to realize that. If you don't believe me, do that little exercise. Did I tell the exercise of how to remember your past lives? Yeah. What's my earliest memory? I think I did earlier. Find out what the earliest memory is. And who knows? You could have been a guy in your last life, Sudama. You could have been an African American. You could have been... who could you have been in your past life? So it's incredible, actually, if you can remember your last lives, to see you can cross the cultural gaps. You know, you can actually understand what it's like to be a woman, because you were before. You can understand what it's like to be sort of an indigenous person who's discriminated against just because their colour is not the right one. You can have those experiences. And you don't get negative about them, because you realise that that's just the vehicle you were in that lifetime. Instead, you actually go to the realm of the mind. That's where we have our essence. That's what we hold in common. So that stops all that discrimination business. But anyhow, you can. If you can, then eventually you will. And again, that's again my job, to keep convince you can. So you haven't yet. But remember that simile I said about, sometimes I can't forget which similes I said, because I gave a talk last night in Nolamara. I give like all these similes during the interviews. I did give the simile about the guy who went to work on a Monday morning. Okay, the guy goes to work on a Monday morning, doesn't get paid Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, only gets paid on Fridays. So he decides to only go to work on Fridays after that. Now, of course, the point is that you build up your credit until you get your paycheck. So much of the thing which you do in meditation is building up your credit. You work meditation after meditation after meditation. Yeah, you don't get a paycheck yet. But your paycheck is in the mail. If it hasn't arrived yet, it will arrive sooner or later, because you've done lots of meditation. Now, you have done lots of letting go. You have sort of sat and walked and done a lot of time on your cushion or on the walking path. So that means that you have created a lot of moments of peace, a lot of gentleness, a lot of letting go. You built up the momentum, built up the credit. It's what I call making good meditation karma. I love the law of karma because I don't just apply it to life, I apply it to my meditation as well. So in the moment I'm sitting here, what am I doing? And in particular, why am I doing it? Where is it coming from? What is my intention? Because that's what the Buddha kept on saying. Chedanam karmam vadami. It's the intention is karma. That's the most important part of it. And I mentioned earlier the intention, the three right intentions, are the intention of making peace, being kind, being gentle. So every time you make peace, every time you're kind, every time you're gentle, you're making skillful, positive meditation karma. And you know the law of karma. You keep doing good karma, eventually it comes back to you. There was this one man, he actually did the tiling and the ablution block down at Bodhinyana many years ago. He was an interesting guy because, you know, he was about this, maybe about 1 year junior to me in Thailand. He was from Sydney. And it was very clear to me he was a very intelligent guy, but he never finished school. He left school early, about 14 or 15. And learned the building trade with his father, especially tiling. And I was really surprised that why this guy, you know, never went to university. He's obviously very smart. And then one day, you know, we had a Time magazine in our monastery which somebody gave. And he came up to me, because he was a really good friend. He said, I've just seen why I didn't go to university, why I didn't finish school. Because there was an article on dyslexia. In those days, it wasn't recognized. People, you know, didn't even know what it meant. And this sort of condition was described imperfectly, highly intelligent, but because he had this learning difficulty which was not recognized, he just never went to university. Instead, he didn't even finish school, but went to be a builder. And a very brilliant builder as well. So when Ajahn Chah became sick, and he needed a special accommodation to stay in, this monk spent a whole year building him the little hut, actually the big hut, where Ajahn Chah spent his last 9 or 10 years. And that's incredible good karma, doing something like that. And then when he came over to Perth, he did a bit of work for us, but you know, he was on the edge and he eventually disrobed. And about 5 or 6 years ago, he went back to Thailand, to Ajahn Chah's monastery, to give a huge donation. Because he'd won the Australian lotto. And he thought, how could I win this lottery? What have I done? And he thought, I built a hut for this great monk. Wow, that must be the reason why. So he gave some of it back. to the monastery. Incredible good story, isn't it? So that's what happens. So we're just finishing off the teacher's cottage where I stay. The nation envelope is in the kitchen over there. No. Sorry, I couldn't resist that. So, when you are making good meditation karma, you get good results all the time. So, if you haven't got your paycheck yet in meditation, don't worry, just make some more good meditation karma. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle, as much as you possibly can. And that is the essence of meditation as far as I'm concerned. So some of you are going to be leaving this evening, and some have already left again, some go tomorrow because you have planes to catch and other things to do. So everyone keeps on asking me, well, what should I do when I go back home? How can I continue this meditation on? And that's actually the answer there. It doesn't matter what you're doing in life. You can always make peace. You can always be kind. You can always be gentle. No matter what you're doing. You're driving your car. You're working on the computer. Stupid computer. I caught myself saying that the other day. So you know what I did yesterday? Because the internet was down. Stroke the computer there. I'm sorry. I apologize. So I'm kind to computer. I know the story I told about the ATM machine. Nice ATM. Wonderful ATM. May your money never run out. May the electricity never go off. May no one ever sort of bang you because they're upset that they've got no credit in their account. It's not your fault, ATM. I know that sometimes people swear at you and bang you. But nice ATM. You're very nice. Gurgle, gurgle, gurgle. $20 comes out. So, but if you are peaceful and kind and gentle, then even at work, things tend to go well. And not only going well, it means that you are developing the reason why meditation works. For those of you who know people like Rodney, who've been around a long time, in the first few years of Bodhidharma Monastery, I worked so hard, just from the early morning to the late in the evening, usually 5 days a week, and then on the weekend going off to what was then our centre in North Perth. Really working hard. No time to meditate. Because if you did try and meditate, you were so exhausted you just fall asleep. It was nature, that's all. But I remember that, I was working hard, and the abbot there at the time, Ajahn Jagra, said, "Oh, you deserve a rest." So he sent me to this disciple in Manjimup's house. And she had a little hut in the back, in a paddock. So I was staying there for a week. It was just R&R, rest and relaxation. But as soon as I went there, after a few hours, my meditation was back, really deep. And I couldn't understand that. Why is your meditation really deep when you've been, haven't hardly meditated for, 6 months? You've just been trying, but just getting sleepy. Why? And I realized, number one, I'd rested, so my body was relaxed again. But I remembered every time I was laying a brick or putting plumbing together, I was really making peace. I was being kind, I was being gentle, I was focusing. And I realized even in that work, that hard physical work, I was making the good meditation karma. It was all building up. It wasn't just laying a brick, it was how you laid the brick. Stupid brick. That's bad meditation karma. We're putting it down gently. Oh, it's not working. Oh, let's take it off and try again. We're putting the pipes together. Come on, there you go. That kindness, that gentleness, that peace, it gets you laying more bricks. Remember one of the builders came up to me. He told me this story about this. He was doing a mansion for this very wealthy man in Sydney. And this guy, had too much money. He said, "Look, I don't care how much it costs. I want the best tradespeople to work on my mansion." And so, what happens, the builder just employed all these people, trying to get the very best. And one day, the rich guy came along to look at the progress. And he saw this young 17-year-old laying the bricks on his mansion. And he blew up. I wanted experts, not apprentices. And I want people who know what they're doing, not some young guy who's just learning his trade. And the builder said, come over here and look at the guy. He said, even though he's only 17, you know, he was laying these bricks and they were so perfect, every one, and much faster than these other people. He said, this is an amazing guy, he's just got this incredible rhythm. And it doesn't look like he's doing any work. But all these bricks are just going down perfectly all the time. So this beautiful skill. He does it so peacefully, so effortlessly. And there's just perfect bricks, and so many get laid. And the rich guy said, wow, yeah, that's true. You know, keep it going. And I like that story because that's actually when you lay your best bricks. When you flow, it's peaceful, hardly any effort, it just flows along. Or like some athletes have told me, they call it like getting into the zone. Getting into the zone means they've been training all their life. But when they have to perform to the highest level, they have to forget everything they were ever told. And really get out of the way and let it happen. And in this zone, they say they're just sitting there or standing there just watching all these amazing things their body does. And they don't do any of it. They're totally letting go. And it's just happening. Without any effort. Because any effort, it's not smooth, it doesn't flow. And they're also the great musicians. You know, in my job, it's a great job being a monk. You meet all these really interesting people. You know, because, you know, you these, you know, top entertainers and sort of politicians and stuff. And they tell you these amazing stories. So, you know, being as a monk or a nun, it opens the doors of places that no one else can go into. You know, like mortuaries, and mansions, and all sorts of interesting palaces, and all sorts of interesting places. So it's a fascinating life being a monk. But anyhow, I've got some great anecdotes, like the time, I'm just anecdoting now, the last time the Queen came to Australia, that was for the Commonwealth Games in Melbourne, and I got an invite. And the invite was to this state dinner at the Grand Hall of Parliament House in Canberra. And you can imagine that, you know, this was John Howard's time, personally signed by John Howard. And these beautiful invitation cards, like you're going to some high class ball. And it's amazing, just I got an invitation to a state dinner. But there was a problem. Because on that invitation card was dress code. Yeah, it was a problem. Because they had three choices. And the first choice was a black, they called it black tie. But you know that you have to wear more than just a black tie. You can't go there naked just with a black tie. That's what it says. Just black tie. It means like the shirt and the suit and everything else. And I can't wear a suit. I haven't got a black... There's not even a black tie, not any colour tie in the whole monastery. So that wouldn't work. So the next choice was military uniform. Which again was really hopeless. But there was a third choice. And the third choice, you know what it was? Long dress. So I said, that's the one for me. So yeah, so it was a lovely time. I rocked up at Parliament House. All these other people, they're generals, you know, in their sort of military uniform, the head of the Australian Army, and all these diplomats in their nice suits and stuff. And there was me in this brown robe, just like you see here, you know, half falling off as usual. The reason it falls off is because I do lots of letting go. And actually, that's another anecdotal story. I'm going anecdote and branching off. This is an important story. I once gave a talk at this executive club over in Netherlands. You know, they had their dinner, they wanted their dinner speaker. And I gave them a talk on meditation, that's what they wanted to hear. And after the talk, one of the execs came up to me, I forget which CEO she was. And she came up to me and said, you know, I've been watching you giving the talk and watching your robe always falling off. And he said, that's very impressive, because that's obviously what you're like. So you don't get tight. You're not attached to things. You know, you're not all this scrunched up mind or scrunched up body. And she said, I went to school in a Catholic convent. And those nuns were so tight. you know, in their sort of their clothes and also in their mind. There was no looseness in there. There was no kindness. There was no openness. And he said, that's very interesting. Just, you know, the body language, the way people dress. And that gives a great indication of just how much of a control freak they are, how tight they are, and how loose they are. So, loosen up. As you do when you're on a meditation retreat. No one wears tight clothes when on a meditation retreat. But just the way you wear the clothes, the way you wear your hair. Look at the way I wear my hair. This is so cool. But anyway, back to Parliament House. So there I was walking in with all the dignitaries. So the security officer came up and said, are you supposed to be here? I got stopped. I said, yeah, look, here's my invitation. Okay. And they let me in. So that was really good fun. So you get to see all these amazing, interesting things as a monk. And that's the fascinating part of this job. But, you know, all the time, no matter what you have to do, it's all the way you do it is the most important. So even with meditation, I mentioned this earlier and it really comes up right now. Whether you're watching a nimitta, or whether you're half asleep, whether you are watching your body, or you're thinking of some sort of fantasy, I don't care. And I mean that. What I really care about is your reaction. Are you making peace with this? Or are you fighting? Are you getting guilty, getting afraid, getting frustrated and negative about yourself? I care about that. Because that is bad meditation karma. If you're saying, oh, this is good enough for me, you know, the check's in the mail, it will happen one day. If you're making peace, well done. Eventually you'll get to the goal. If you're being kind, oh, look, this is my first retreat. It's a hard thing I'm doing. It's a wonderful, I've lasted this long. It's great, all the wonderful things I've done. I've gone to chanting. You know, I've been able to get up early in the morning. I've gone without a big meal in the evening. I've done amazing things. Well done, you're so kind to yourself. Then, well done. You're on the path. But if you feel, I've really been wasting my time, I'm such a stupid. I don't know why Ajahn Brahm tolerates me being here. Really, if he didn't know what I've been really doing, and I know what you've been really doing, he should have thrown me out here for the first day. No. Don't think like that to yourself. Be so kind to yourself. And also, never force yourself. Never go along and sort of say, right, this is it, I'm going to sit, I'm going to not move. I've only got one day left. So, you know, no messing around, okay, this is it. Now, that's not gentle, that's so aggressive. And if you are aggressive, that is what I think is going to be terrible. It's not what you're doing, but how you do it. That is good meditation karma. And once you understand that point, you understand why people sometimes they sit down and it happens, they get a deep meditation. You think, why? What do? They haven't been sitting very long. No, but what they've been doing when they've been working, when they've been eating, when they've been helping in the kitchen, doing their duties, they've been making peace, being kind, being gentle all the time. They've been making the causes for deep meditation. So when it does come the time to sit on the meditation chair or on your cushion, you've made so much good karma. It's like the postman is just waiting for you, waiting for you, waiting for you to get home on your cushion so you can deliver the mail and you get your paycheck. And that's what it's like. You sit here one day, totally unexpected because you've been busy. You sit here and you bliss out. Wow, this is so wonderful. Please understand where that came from. All those moments of peace, all that kindness, all that generosity. I should mention generosity again at the end of a retreat. Real generosity is giving, expecting nothing back in return. That's real generosity. I've been to some temples, especially in Asia, where they have all the names of the donors written on the wall. That's not generosity. That's advertising. Advertising your ego. So you never see any names on the walls of any donors in this place The reason is because it's just giving. You don't expect things back in return. And that's exactly how you meditate. You give. Give your mindfulness to this moment with making peace, kind, gentle, not expecting anything back in return. That's a wonderful thing about generosity. It's a beautiful form of letting go. But few people know real generosity. They always want a thanks, a tax receipt. They want the name acknowledged in the newsletter. It's not real generosity. Real generosity is giving, expecting nothing back in return. You give your mindfulness to this moment, expecting nothing back in return. This is your gift to the Buddha or whatever else you want to believe in. This is your gift, but you don't expect anything back. So for the next day, the next 24 hours or 30 hours, however long we've got, or 7 days and 30 hours if you ask me to extend this retreat, please give, expecting nothing back in return. Give every moment. Give your energy to every moment. But please don't expect anything. Look, it's been 8 days, you haven't got anything. Do you expect really you're going to get anything now? You're hopeless. Just give up. Come on. And then you might get something. So it's the causes. You put those into place, then the effects happen. So that's why I love the idea of like generosity, real generosity. I love giving. I can't give any money, but I love giving my time. Giving my time to you guys, you know, speaking and giving interviews. Unfortunately, I can't do the interviews this afternoon because I've given my time to one of the people in Nolomar. They're getting married this afternoon. I know marriage is very difficult these days. You need all the help you can get. So that's why I go there, to try and make sure. Because look, what happens, you know, these are regulars who come to Nolomar, and if the marriage doesn't work, they're going to get married anyway. I try to stop them, but you know, you can't do it. With all the marriage jokes. Should I do the marriage jokes? Okay, the marriage jokes, okay. First of all, the three rings of marriage. What's the first ring of marriage? Engagement ring. Second ring of marriage? The wedding ring. The third ring of marriage? Suffer ring. Yes. What really amazes me is everybody laughs at that. Which shows it's true. I never knew what happiness was until I got married. And then it was too late. A woman is not complete until she finds a husband. And when she does find a husband, then she's finished. When I was courting my wife, before we were married, we used to hold hands out of love. I now have been married 10 years, and I still hold her hand. Isn't that sweet? But I hold her hand out of self-defense. Okay, enough about the marriage. So they need all the help they can get. So that's why I won't be here this afternoon. But I love doing this because I give. I mean, I get good meditation as well. And the reason is because when I do give, I give, I make peace, I'm kind, I'm gentle, and I have fun. That's the other thing I wanted to mention. Please, whatever you do in your life, if you're washing the dishes in the kitchen, make it fun. You know, see if you can wash the dishes a different way. And actually, you do it in the machine, don't you? That makes things very difficult. But please make fun with whatever you're doing. Because if you make fun with whatever you're doing, when you have your lunch, see if you can make fun with your lunch. Whatever you put together in a really weird way. So if you have a banana, have it sticking up from the last. Because you know what fun does? That engages you in the moment. You're right here. When somebody tells a joke, have you ever noticed how present you are? You're really here. But have you ever noticed when people give these boring sermons, it goes on and on and on, you're fantasizing somewhere else, you're looking at sort of text messages, you know, you're just looking at your feet, you're scratching your head, anything. You're not here. But when it's really enjoyable, then of course you pay attention. So that's why joy, happiness, it actually brings you into the present moment. It's a great way of developing mindfulness and energy. So that's, I did see someone over there, they were actually meditating at 90 degrees, they were facing that wall. Well done. It's the only person I've seen. Someone actually, they said they have done the walking meditation, the kangaroo hop. Well done. Then actually you're here, you make peace, you're being kind, you're being gentle, you're making fun, and then your meditation takes off. You know, sometimes you don't believe me. You think this is just indulging, you're just being too soft. You know, you should be more fierce. But it doesn't work. I've been doing this for so many years. You know, sometimes I have taught split retreats. People get tense and they go away and they don't come back again. One of the problems is here is people still keep coming back. You know, this retreat was supposed to be for people who've never done retreats with me before, to give other people a chance. There's always like waiting lists. So this actually works. So now you know what to do. When you go home, you know, you can just meditate at home. You can always be peaceful, be kind, be gentle. Whatever you're doing, you're in the car, driving to work, don't get angry at people, make peace, be kind, be gentle. With your partner in life, make peace with them. No more wars. Be kind, be gentle with them. And maybe they may be peaceful and kind and gentle to you too. And more important, with your body and your mind, always be kind. Make peace, be gentle. You may not have the best body in the world. It may be giving you hell. You know why it's giving you hell? Because you've mistreated it for a long time. Now it's getting its own back. So the only thing you can do is that, okay, I deserve this. Make peace, be kind, be gentle with it, and at least the pain will be alleviated. And then make peace, be kind, be gentle with your mind. And then your mind will come very, very peaceful. And you find it so easy to meditate. You've been working hard, doing all these jobs for other people, and you sit down there and you bliss out. Beautiful. Well done. That's how it works. Wisdom power. Not those stupid people who sit, right, you know, oh, this is it, I'm going to meditate 9 days, I'm going to get enlightened. Ugh. Willpower does not work. You may try that if you wish, but it doesn't work. The wisdom power, the kindness, the peace, the gentleness does. So that you can do here. That you can do when you go home. That you can do anywhere. So off you go and become enlightened. Get those jhanas. See what happens. And of course, some of you may think, well, maybe not. Some monks say jhanas are important. Some people say that you can get enlightened without the jhanas. That doesn't matter. What really matters is you can't get enlightened without making peace, without being kind, without being gentle. So that silly debate, do you need jhanas to become enlightened, or you do you not need jhanas to be enlightened? Put that away. You certainly need peace to be enlightened. You need kindness. You need gentleness. So that's all you need to do. Of course you will find that jhanas are necessary for enlightenment. Put that aside. Who cares? Stop making big fuss and bother about it. And then you know the path. The path is what we practice. And then great things happen. So you have a whole day in front of you. There is... Well, what time does the retreat finish? I don't know. Sunday afternoon sometime. So say it's 3 o'clock, that's 30 hours you've got left. That's 1,800 minutes. That's 108,000 seconds. That's auspicious. 108 is a magic number in Buddhism. So you're so lucky, you've got 108,000 seconds. And anyone, you just need 1 second to get jhana. 1 moment to become enlightened. So you've got 108,000 chances left. Heaps of time. So go and take a rest.